the curious monkey would come along and he would stick his paw in the hole and he would grab a hold of that banana. But as soon as he grabbed a hold of the banana, he can't get his paw back out. And he won't let go. So the hunter would come along, grab the monkey right up, never realizing all he needed to do to get out of the trap was to let go of that thing that he thought he wanted and needed. I grew up in the church. And all I can tell you, growing up Baptist, was that I always felt like I had something that I needed to prove to God to be worthy. And I grew up with a lot of social anxiety, self-esteem problems, a lot of fear. I remember my earliest memories in preschool, looking at other kids laughing and playing and being open with each other, and I never felt like them. I never felt like that. In my mind, if I opened up and I really told you or showed you who I was, I wouldn't be worthy of your attention. I wouldn't be worthy of your approval. And I held on to that view of myself the entire time I was growing up. You remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this cool little thing they used to have in the malls, these posters, and they looked like just pixelated mess. But if you stood back enough and you kind of unfocused your eyes, you could see images in the pictures. That was my experience in church. People would be standing in front of these pictures that to me looked like just pixelated mess, but they would see things that I couldn't see. And I would look around and Lord knows, I wanted to experience what they were experiencing. I was open to that idea, and it just never happened for me. When I was in my late teens, I finally had that crisis of faith where I had begun to blame God and then to question God's existence. And I really wanted to believe, and I remember going to my youth group at the time and asking questions. And what I experienced was, don't ask questions. And this wasn't imagined. I wish it was. But the church I was in asked me not to come back. And it's funny because all of my life I've had these feelings of insecurity with nothing to back it up. I had good parents, a great home. There was nothing that happened to me bad that could justify these feelings of insecurity until then. So I've got this cart full of bad feelings, and what that event did was it gave me a horse, and I was able to take that cart wherever I wanted. I started searching for God. I thought, well, you know, this doesn't work, so I'll try Buddhism, Hinduism. I was a voracious reader. I was also a pretentious little intellectual. I knew just enough to question your faith. Those bad experiences finally, you know, I was this good kid, played bass in the church band, had a little Christian rock and roll band, and when the bad thing happened, I crossed the street to all the goth punks, went down to Little Five Points, gave away all my colored clothes, bought all my black clothes, and got my punk rock membership card. And I left Lakeside. I was at Lakeside High School. I left Lakeside and went to Open Campus, which is where all the freaks went. And what was cool about that was I had two things going for me. I was a bass player. And in a world of guitarists and vocalists, I always had a job. And I didn't drink or do drugs, which meant I was also the designated driver. And I worked for a long time in various like local high school punk bands. In the early 90s, I was playing in a metal band called Serpentine Waltz. And we were getting noticed, which at that time, you know, B and C level bands would come into town and they would be playing places like Center Stage or the Roxy, what's now Buckhead Theater, and they would look for local bands to be the opener. And we started doing that, and then we also started going all over the Southeast as openers for these bands. And I remember on June 11th, 1990, I was at a party after a show, and somebody handed me a beer. And I'd never drank. I was 20 years old. This was 6 months before my 21st birthday. All my friends had been drinking and drugging for a long time, and I was always the one that stood back and, you know, didn't participate, kind of was the wallflower and just watched it happen. And I don't know why I drank at that time, but something really amazing happened. And it's like textbook alcoholic, because I experienced Wizard of Oz in reverse. I have courage. I can talk. I haven't got a brain. And somebody dropped a house on my sister. It was like I found the answer. I found the cure. I was able to interact socially. I was able to share my feelings. I didn't feel that anxiety. It was the cure. That was the 11th of June. By July 4th, the next big show we had, the next big party, I was drinking every day and smoking pot every day. It was that quick. It was my spiritual substitute. Without a foundation and a context for a spiritual life, I had a way that I could interact with people. I could feel at peace with myself. I could express myself. It was very much that substitute that I'd looked for. I was safe for a little while. We're just going to drink, smoke some pot. Then the LSD, and wow. Talk about a spiritual substitute. Sit out on the lawn, stare up the skies. You feel the gears of the universe turning. You feel a part of everything. It's awesome. And then we started going on those trips, opening for bands all over. You go down to Jacksonville, and the promoter or the club guy would usher the bands in. He meets everybody individually. There's a mirror there with lines on it, and they're snorting coke through rolled up dollar bills. It was just part of the culture, which is not an excuse. I knew what I was doing. I knew it was a tiger. I knew I was grabbing the tail. I just didn't know it was going to bite so hard for me. And it was kind of a slippery slope, because I snorted it, and I've always had sinus problems, and it really bothered me after a while. You know, I'd get all locked up, and that didn't feel good. You're high, and you're uncomfortable. So then I tried ingesting it, and that didn't work either, and somebody said, how about the needle? And it made perfect sense at the time. William Blake wrote that the path to wisdom is paved with excesses. And I was trying to be real wise. He also says, you never know what is enough until you know what is too much. And, you know, mothers with kids will teach their kids, look, the eye of the stove, when it's red like that, it's hot. And some kids will listen. Most kids will touch it that one time and go, she's telling the truth. And then some kids will get up every morning and touch the stove just to make sure that it works today the same way it worked yesterday. Figuring out what is enough and what is too much was a constant struggle. I was always going to that wall and sometimes going over. And going over sometimes meant coming to on a dirty bathroom floor with a needle still in my arm, blood and puke all over me. And I remember one time waking up and looking around and outfit ruined again and thinking to myself, again? I knew I had a problem. And I knew it was going to get worse. And I had an idea that that I needed to do something about it, and I wasn't sure how. Okay, I'm gonna tell you something that I didn't really expect I would say. And I don't know why. But I'm gonna tell you something that I've told my wife and I've told one other person in my whole life. There was a reason that I quit doing drugs. And it was a night I was home alone, and a friend of mine came over. He was also my dealer. Dealers were always friends. My dealer came over, and I was really, really high. He sexually molested me. I've never said that in front of anybody before, but just my wife and one other person. And the reason I think I need to say that is because what happened after that was I blamed myself. That's what we do. We blame ourselves. If the reason I'm saying this is for you, it's time to stop blaming yourself. But I turned that around on myself, and one of the ways that I coped with it was it was because I was high. So quit. Cold turkey. And I did it by drinking more. Instead of being an addict that drank a lot, I just became an alcoholic that drank all the time. Alcohol was really functional because it let me live with all that pain. I could drink the pain away. I could drink the questions away. And in the early 2000s, it made me stop playing music because I stopped feeling it. After, you know, a decade of playing in various bands, I put my bass up, and with few exceptions, I didn't touch it for about 8 years. And instead, I turned my focus on my job and becoming more socially acceptable. I was never a day drinker. I would go to work all day and do what I had to do and then go home and drink at night and then wash, rinse, repeat. Met a woman and married her, and it was like 10 minutes long because she had it in her eyes that she could fix me, and as soon as she figured out she couldn't fix me, it was over. But that was okay because I found another one. Not that one. This one liked me sick. She had a beautiful 3-year-old daughter whose father was never really in the picture. So I had instant family. And that was really good because it quieted things down a little bit. I actually slowed down. I didn't stop, but I slowed down. I became a more highly functioning alcoholic, very driven. Got the house in the burbs, in the good school system for the kid. And I would be home at every night. And things worked really, really good for a long time. But for any alcoholic and addict, you know that you'll slow down, you'll get things under control, but that's never enough. And it's you know, part of it is, what is happiness? My happiness was contingent upon a noun, person, place, thing, idea. It was always something external. And if you make your happiness contingent upon that external thing, you give your power away, because that person that you place your happiness on may one day decide that you're not the one for them. And when they turn away, what happens? Everything falls apart. Places, things, jobs, income. And it was always, you know, if I get this, I'm going to be happy. If I get this job and this person, I'm going to be happy. And then you get it. But because you're not right here, that's not enough. You're still not happy. It's the next thing. It's always the next thing. And I had all those things that I thought I should want and that I thought I should have, that I worked hard for, and it still wasn't right. Getting what you want and still not being happy. At the end of my drinking, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I had to stop, but I just didn't know how I was going to do that and hold on to all those things, because I felt like if I stopped drinking, I was going to fall apart. I was going to lose the kid. I was going to lose the house. I was going to lose all my friends. I was going to lose my wife. Those four things kept me running that rat race, but thinking that it was my pain because I had everything together except in my own head. And that's what I said to myself as I continued to fight this battle and try to control my drinking. And when I turned 40, I was really trying to stop. There was like 2 months in there that I was either going to stop or I was going to kill myself. That was a real battle. I was afraid to do the suicide thing because of the kid. I loved my kid. And I thought, well, you know, if I can just manage to keep things together and get her raised and get her through school and get her happy, my happiness doesn't matter. This is my pain. I'm gonna fight this fight. And my last drunk stayed up Saturday night, and some folks came over, and we were all grilling out and having a good time, which was always the way it started. And then it ended with everybody going home or going to bed, and me on the back porch listening to old sad country songs and drinking myself into an absolute stupor. Because I didn't go to sleep, I passed out. And I woke up in the morning, and that whole area on the patio was a mess, and Sarah's like, "Mom's a little mad at you." And I was like, "Yeah, she would be. What are we gonna do to salvage this? We're gonna clean everything up, gather everything together, and do the recycling. Just something to let her know that, yep, I know I screwed up, and I'm gonna do this." So I said, "Sarah, you want to come with me?" She says, "Absolutely." So we gathered up all the recycling, which hadn't been done in 2 weeks, so there was a lot of it. You know, green beer bottles and brown beer bottles and clear beer bottles and brown wine bottles and green wine bottles and just all this glass. And we went over by the DeKalb Farmers Market, and we're sorting through. She's helping me sort through. Clear beer bottles, green beer bottles, brown beer bottles. Here's my 12-year-old kid sorting through all of my trash. And I'm looking, and it's just working on me. Denial's a funny thing. Because this whole time I thought, well, you know, this is my nightmare, this is my pain. And that was that last little thing that I held on to, was as long as things are okay with her, then I'll be okay. And she turned around and she said, "Why don't you just stop drinking?" And I can never tell this story right, because I always look at her and she's laughing because that wasn't the way it happened. But I'm on a live mic, so I'm not going to scream the way she screamed. She just, in front of God and everybody, she's screaming at me, "Just stop drinking." And that one last little illusion that I was holding on to, that it was my pain, that's what we do. We hold on to these illusions. And as long as that illusion was intact, I could go on and I could do what I was doing. And I would always have the bottle. But what I realized was that nightmare that I was having about you know, this disease and what I was going to go through, that wasn't my nightmare. That was hers. But because she was going to be with me for every single blow. As I slowly destroyed myself, she was going to be with me for every single blow. And that's when I went and I found AA. I found my AA group and went to my first meeting the next day. And that was November 8th, 2009. That was my sobriety date. Now, I hadn't thought much about God in a long time. And AA is a spiritual program. First three steps in short order, the short version. I can't do it. God can. I'm gonna let him. But now that God thing was tripping me up, because I never made a successful atheist, but I made a great agnostic. And my idea was, yeah, there's God, but obviously doesn't care about me, because look what he let me do. But I got into the program, and the program kind of became my God for a little while, because all I needed to do was say, I can't do it. I need help. And I relied on those people that I met in the program for a long time. And it was a good 6 months that I was doing what they told me to do. Head was clearing. Things were getting a little bit better. And I'm sitting in a meeting one day, and I'm looking around, and it suddenly hits me, because I'm with all these people that have very similar stories to mine. And at that time, the idea of Moses parting the Red Sea or Jesus walking on water, they were really good stories. Looked good on paper. I had never experienced anything miraculous like that in my life, and I just didn't believe it. And I'm sitting in the meeting, and I'm looking around at these people that all have these similar stories. And here I have just over 6 months clean. And I haven't had 6 months clean in almost 20 years. And I'm with people that had 5 years clean and 10 years clean. And it suddenly occurred to me that was a miracle. And I experienced something that I can only imagine in my head. It was like God setting his hand on my shoulder and going, this is a miracle. I was absolutely positive that this effort, this 6 months sobriety, was not mine. I did not do this. I tried to clean up way too many times on my own. And it didn't happen until I turned my will over to something. And I'm driving on the way home, and I pull over. Because it's like everything locked into place. I attempted suicide once. I know I nearly overdosed 3 times. I hopped a moving train 2 times. One time one-handed with a bottle in the other hand. And I think about all these things, and I realize, you know, all that time that I thought I was going through this madness by myself, and I realized I wasn't by myself. God was protecting me the whole time. There were so many ways. And it was like the footprints in the sand, where there's the 2 footprints. One of those 2 footprints, well, then God says, that was when you and I were walking together. What about that 1 footprint? Why did you leave me? Oh, no, no, no. That was when I was carrying you. What about those skid marks? That's when I was dragging your really obstinate behind across the sand. Some people say that the truth will set you free. Some people say the truth will hurt. I think the truth will set you free, but it's going to hurt. Because I got involved in church, and here I am for the first time in my life getting down on my knees and praying and really feeling like God is moving in my life and things are getting better. And then I lost all my friends. All those friends that I'd had for 15, 16 years. And that wasn't a big surprise, because I drank and drugged with these guys, and why would they want to hang out with me now? That was okay. The long version is a lot of therapy and a lot of talking. The short version is my wife looked at me and said, I liked you better when you were drunk. I want a divorce. You know, in my mind, I'm cleaning up. I'm doing all these things that I'm supposed to do. Why is this happening now? Well, when you get together with somebody that while you're sick, there's usually a reason. Because she wasn't a drinker, but there was a lot of sickness going on. And when I started cleaning up and going to church, she just kind of looked and went, that's not what I signed up for. So all these things that I was afraid of losing in that first year and a half of sobriety, I lost them all. It was, at the time, it was like the worst thing that had ever happened to me. Here I am, sober, and it was even worse than some of the stuff that I'd gone through before. Only now I see what it was God was removing all those things that were between he and I. And in the process of rebuilding, armed with my faith in God's will, God said, trust me. Now I'm going to give you what you really deserve, what I'd had planned for you all along. And I look back on the worst day of my life now, and I see it was the best. And that's a concept that, you know, I think it's at least important sometimes when we're letting go of the past. You know, got all those things that we've been carrying with us. The way I approached my future was I had all these vast plans, what I needed to do, what I needed to achieve, and when they didn't happen, I had something else to regret and resent, and I put it with the rest of the stuff in my past, and it made my current moment perpetual suffering. And I think sometimes letting go of our expectations of the future is at least as important as letting go of the past. When I learned to live in the moment for God's will, what I got in return was, I lost the wife, I lost the house, I lost the friends, I got to keep the kid. God clear-cut that field. And what regrew was a relationship with a woman who is my equal, my equally yoked spiritual partner, and someone who puts her relationship with God and her sobriety before me, which is so important. And I came here. And what I found here, and what I absolutely love, and I was talking about this a couple weeks ago with somebody, what's really cool about this church is there's like a room full of broken people. A room full of broken and scarred people. And we come here, and many of us, for the first time in our lives, are finding a God who loves us and who accepts us for who we are, and a community of believers who love us and accept us for who we are. And it's my feeling that anytime you go through something like I went through, like many of you have your own stories, it makes us uniquely qualified to help somebody else in that same position. And we come in here and we find somebody who's, I know that hell. I've been there too. And, you know, by extending ourselves to each other and helping someone, using our strength, our hope, and our experience to help somebody else, we heal. That, to me, is one of the most important things. When we have the courage to make other people's happiness and well-being an important component to our own, it changes everything. My goodness. I think I'm going to leave it right there.
Wow. Let me tell you, if you do not know Charles and Kathy, do yourself a favor and get to know those people. You are such a blessing and wonderful addition to this church. We love you both very, very much. A few weeks ago when PK and I were on the phone talking about who he wanted to do testimonies, he said, I want Charles. I feel like Charles is that's supposed to give their testimony. And he said, then I feel like you're the second one. I said, oh, no. Remember, I did mine years ago. He said, that was your story then. This is your story now, and you need to share it. And what's really funny is While I've never been addicted to drugs or alcohol or anything, Charles and my story have a little parallel. And if you'll just listen and trust me a little bit, it'll show in the end. So this last 3 years has been quite a ride for me. 3 years ago, I was in a job that I'd been in for about 5 years. Martin and I worked together at the same place. I was paid really well, but there were some problems. We worked for people that were not Christian. They demanded staff to be practically on call 24/7. I was under so much stress with that job that I felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown any time. The year before, in 2011, the business went through multiple lawsuits due to a product that was misused by consumers. What happened is the company went into Chapter 11 restructuring. We were eventually bought out by another company. That buyout, it helped calm some fears brought on by those events, but the changes were both good and bad. It's not easy to go from a family-owned business to a larger corporate business. The new company, they, in their wisdom, decided to migrate us to their 20-year-old antiquated computer system. We lost all of our accrued vacation and sick time. On the flip side, the former owners did become a little bit more humble and almost more human to deal with once in a while. The new company decided that many areas of the business can be consolidated, which made perfect business sense. Some jobs were going to stay in the Atlanta office. Some jobs were going to go to the corporate office in Bolivar, Missouri, which is about this big. We were all pretty nervous for a long time, trying to find out what was going to happen. And on September the 12th, I found out my fate. My position got eliminated. I'd been praying to God for a long time for things to change, and was that things were going to go back to normal. What God expected threw me for a loop. He wanted me out of my comfort zone in a mighty big way. Just because we're going through uncomfortable times in our life, it doesn't mean that that's not where we're supposed to be. And during those times, God is preparing us for something better. He's refining us. So take it from somebody who knows. Don't try to change every situation yourself. Let God work through you with this. He knows what you're capable of. He's preparing you for new opportunities, new growth, maybe a new job, new friends, who knows. So that day, Jackson and I packed up our things at work because he was able to go to the office with me every day. Jackson is my 14-year-old Jack Russell Terrier, if any of you have been asleep and haven't seen my Facebook page in the last 13 years. First thing I did was call Pastor Keith on the way home. I recall being very calm during that phone call. He asked me if I was okay. I said, I really am. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I did know that I would not have to spend one more day dreading going to that job. Over the next few months, while I looked for another job, I did whatever was necessary. I contracted work, I cleaned houses, I pet set, I organized, I did all sorts of things. I accepted a job in April 2013 with a small IT support company here in town. They had created this position for me based on my resume. It was, if you will, a Jane of all trades sort of job. I was doing things I love, customer service, accounts payable, payroll, a few other things, new things that I was learning. But I wasn't being used to my potential, and I knew it. I completed tasks pretty quick because, you know, procrastination is not something that I'm aware even exists for myself anyway. I picked up their software really quickly, and I was able to teach them a few things about the software that they weren't utilizing. So I was bored a lot because I would run out of things to do. I'd ask my supervisor for work, but she wouldn't give me things because she didn't feel like I was ready for them. Now, when I took this job, it was less money than I was accustomed to, but I had enough to cover my bills. That was good. The company agreed to start me out at a certain rate, and then in 90 days, they were going to increase me, and also my insurance would begin. So About day 125, after asking my supervisor several times about the benefits, she called me into her office, and she let me know that my position was being eliminated because they didn't feel like they really needed this position, and they really couldn't afford me anyway. So, and then the last thing she said, I think she meant for it to be a compliment, but she said with all of my experience that I could actually do her job. Now, keep in mind, she was the controller for this company. You'll need to know that little piece of information later. Back to square one. Sent out more resumes, and a company contacted me just a couple of days later. I had a phone interview. I did two face-to-face interviews. They hired me. So I was out of a job less than 2 weeks. The position in that company was very similar to the one that I had lost a couple of years ago. So I was able to bring that expertise and experience to this new job. Funny thing, about 18 months later, they decided they couldn't afford my position either. I decided, all right, God, you've given me these organizational abilities, and I've always had a little side business anyway, so I decided that it was time to start developing that business. And I was doing pretty well with it, and I stayed busy a lot with projects, and so life was good. Mid-March, a few of us went to see Joel Osteen, and at the time, it was the encouragement that I needed. I love Joel, and he's such an encourager and has such a great message of hope. And during that event, Martin and I were sitting next to each other, and he leaned over to me, and he said that he kept hearing the words from me, gainfully employed. About 2 weeks later, I was at home about 8 o'clock one night, and the phone rang, and I didn't know the number, but I thought, with all these resumes out there, I better answer the phone. And it was a recruiter, and he said he found my resume on the internet. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, okay, what sales job are you calling me about? Because that seems to be all that calls you for a while is people with sales jobs. So he said that he had found my resume by searching for this particular software name that I had used with the former IT support company. The funny thing is, that's the only software besides like Office that I even named on my resume, which, okay, if that's not a little bit of a God thing, I don't know what is. I was only with that IT support company for 4 months, but hey, experience is experience. So he asked me if I was available for an interview, and I told him that I was getting ready to go on vacation and I'd be out of town for the next week. And he said that the owner was willing to wait and talk to me after I got back, but could I do a phone interview? So we did. The next day, the owner and I talked on the phone for nearly an hour. I was very encouraged by this conversation. This wonderful man of God that has been put in my life, he took me to a surprise trip to Disney for my birthday. I'd never been, and it was an incredible experience. TJ, we've known each other since 2011. He had come to church a few times, and then for Pastor Gina's birthday party, we sat next to each other and got to start knowing each other a little bit more. And over the years, we had done things in groups and talked on the phone sometimes and things like that. So last year, we decided that there were some other feelings there, and we decided to actually make it official and start dating. So, in fact, we just celebrated our one-year anniversary a few days ago on August 1st. Back to the job thing. I met the owner of the company at Starbucks. We talked for about 10 minutes. He asked me when I could start, and I said, well, that's the kick. I've got all these commitments with my own little company, and I said, I really want to honor those commitments. And he said, I would expect nothing less. He said, can you start working for me part-time while you finish up those projects? And me being the person I am said, well, no problem. Of course I can do that. So we agreed on what the job would entail, and he made me a salary offer. The salary offer was the same money that I was making with the company that had laid me off a couple of years ago. And remember, I was being paid very well at that company, so I was absolutely ecstatic. I got the job offer letter when I was at Martin's house one day, and all I could do was cry. I couldn't believe how God was being so wonderful like he always is. So I started part-time there April 28th, and I started going full-time on June 10th as the company's controller. I really do love my job. I can't wait to get to work every single day. My boss values my opinion. He actually allows me to do my job. He's encouraging, and best of all, he is a Christian. That makes a huge difference. During my time in between jobs, Martin and I lived about 3 miles from each other, and he had recently left that company that laid me off. So I truly believe that God opened up the time for he and I to rekindle our friendship, and it was such a blessing to be able to spend that time with you. I hope you know that. I had been renting a little basement apartment in Decatur, which I really did like, and I love Decatur. This was a friend of mine that I rented from, and she decided one day last year that she wasn't going to continue renting the apartment, and I had to find somewhere to move. And at the time she decided that, I was like, okay, I have no job. I was trying to grow my business, and I had to move. So I looked for places that I could afford to live, and I knew that I really didn't want to be in an actual apartment complex with the dogs. So what I did, I wrote down a list of everything that I wanted in a little rental house. I knew that I wanted to stay around $800 a month. I wanted a fenced yard, a place for a dog door, 2 bedrooms, a garage. So every day I would pull that list out, and it would be during my prayer time, and I would say, God, these are the things I want. If you don't ask God for what you want, you're never, ever going to get it. I think it's very important to do that. I had scoured Craigslist and Zillow and any other site that I could find, and I decided that since I now had this new job, that I needed to look in the Cobb County area, because as much as I love Decatur, I hate 285. I have a friend who I've known for about 10 years since I moved to Atlanta. She lives in Cobb County. She knows everybody in the county just about. So I messaged her one night and I said, hey, I'm looking for a house to rent. Do you know of anybody that might have one? And she wrote back immediately. She sent me an email of a friend of hers and said, this guy has a house. I don't know any details about it. I email him. He writes back immediately with a Craigslist link of a house. I pull it up. It's a house I've seen on Craigslist 15 times, but I kept ignoring it because it was in Austell. I didn't want to live all the way out in Austell. I had several houses that I wanted to go look at, and so one day Martin and I trip over to Cobb County, and this little house that Jeff had sent me the link for, we went and looked at it. We didn't meet him or any of the owners at the houses. We just drove by. I fell in love with this little house instantly, and I could see in the vision of me and the dogs being there. Great thing is the rent's $825 a month. If I pay it by the first, it's $800. I have not only a fenced backyard, but a fenced front yard, too. I have 2 bedrooms. I have all the things that I ask God for, with the exception of the garage. I can live without a garage. I'm 20 to 30 minutes from work, depending on what time I go, and I'm less than 15 minutes from TJ now. We used to be 45 minutes apart. I'm closer to more friends because half of you live in Cobb County. So the great thing is that during all of this journey, from the moment I was laid off in 2012 to now, is I realized I never had to worry about how my bills were going to get paid. Would I be able to keep my car, my insurance, food on the table, all that? God always brought jobs, projects, right when I needed them. He put friends in my path that would take me to dinner, pay my way to movies or events. He even put gas in my car. Helped me without even asking on bills. That's God. That is God. I couldn't have made the move from Decatur to Austell without the financial and moral help of some very dear friends. And even after those loans are paid off, I'll be forever in their debt. Their kindness and unselfish acts will mean more to me than they'll ever know. I want to tell you about some of the blessings during this 3-year journey. You know, in job number one, I gained a lot of experience that helped me land jobs after that. I also learned a lot about how not to treat employees. The small software company that I worked with, I learned a software that unknowingly would get me a better, much better job. I gained a wonderful friend at that job. She and I even share the same birthday. Job number three, I got more experience. I made a wonderful friend. She was not just a friend, but she was an inspiration and a mentor while I was at that job. Even now, we talk regularly. We have lunch when our schedules allow. So I feel like adding new friends is always wonderful. Also, during this 3-year journey is when TJ and I decided to make it real. I got time to spend with friends. Mr. Jackson Poole, a bad thing is he was diagnosed with cancer. However, it's a slow-growing, non-aggressive type. Miss Eva came into my life. They are characters, the two of them together. I got a new place to live, which I absolutely love. Friends helped me get there. I've got a great job with a good salary and benefits, and I'm finally learning that work-life balance, which is very important. But mostly, God gave me back the confidence in myself that I was lacking for a while. But there's always a but. I had to learn how to become humble. I had to learn to accept help. That's very, very difficult. But mainly, I had to rely on God to control the situation. For a control freak, that's not real easy. I had to learn to let Him control the situation and meet every need. He did. I promise He did. So the moral of this story is that even though you may lose some things that appear to be really important along the way, God's going to replace them with something even better. I want to change gears for just a minute, and bear with me. I know we're at 12:30, but this won't take but just a couple more minutes. The last time I gave my testimony years ago was about how at 13 I gave my life to Christ, because at 13 I was at the end of my rope. I was sexually molested by an older brother. It started more than likely when I was an infant, because I could never remember it not happening. God was the only answer. I'd been to church off and on. My mom dropped me off at church. To make matters worse, I grew up Seventh-day Adventist. So I was a kid that was out in left field, and I went to church on the wrong day of the week. He not only stole my virginity and my innocence, but He stole my childhood. And that's why going to Disney for this 52-year-old woman for the first time was so important. I told TJ that I felt like a 7-year-old for the first time in my life, and I really did. Through Christ and a wonderful counselor, I came to terms with the abuse, and I ended up, while not forgetting what happened to me, I was able to forgive him. About 20 years ago, he got into drugs very heavily. He lost a fantastic job. He lost his marriage. He lost his children. He lost his home. He lost everything. I've got 4 other siblings, and none of us have heard from him in the last 20 years. On Thursday last week, I received a call that Ray had died on July 30th. This was kind of surprising, because actually, since we hadn't heard from him in so long, we thought he had already passed away. From what we've been able to piece together, he died alone in the hospital without any friends or family, which is sad enough on its own. But my biggest question is, was he saved? And we're never going to know that please. If you have not given your life over to Christ, do it now. Don't let your friends and family wonder once you've left this earth if you're going to heaven or not. Our pastors will pray with you. They'll assist you in making the best commitment you could ever make in your entire life. And lastly, if you or someone you know has either experienced sexual abuse or you've had an addiction problem or anything else that's holding you back, let us pray with you. Let us help you find some counseling or a program that we can get you into. I love how God works because he and I didn't talk. We had no idea what was going on. He didn't even know I was going to be giving my testimony today. So I thank you for listening to our stories, and God bless you.